This is Democracy Optimist. Here's your host, Professor Joshua Douglas of the University of Kentucky Rosenberg College of Law.
What does it mean? To be American.
Many people have asked me about the name of this show, Democracy Optimist. Can I really be optimistic given everything that has happened recently? My answer is simple. Optimism does not mean I think everything is great. It's about hope for the future and what we can become as a country if we remain clear-eyed about the risks and take bold action to save our democracy. It's a statement of intent. That starts, in my view, with civic education, which is why I am so excited to speak with our guest today, Ben Sheehan. Ben is the host, writer, and producer of Civics Made Easy, a series on PBS that empowers viewers with the knowledge necessary to participate in democracy. He also writes a Substack titled Politics Made Easy. He is the author of the best-selling book, What Does the Constitution Actually Say? A non-boring guide to how our democracy is supposed to work. Basically, Ben has done it all in trying to explain our Constitution and democracy to a wide audience. I actually had the pleasure to be interviewed by Ben for the PBS series, Civics Made Easy. So now the roles are reversed, and I have the honor of learning from him. Ben, welcome to Democracy Optimist.
I'm optimistic and happy to be here.
Great. Well, where did you gain that passion for optimism through civics education and then wanting to educate others?
I grew up in Washington, D.C., and I had one parent who worked in the United States Senate. And she had a 15-year career, and she would come home and talk about the things that they were able to accomplish that day, things like funding for NPR and PBS and early childhood education and the arts and all these different things. And I really got conditioned on understanding that the government is designed to benefit us and make our lives better. And I got to see examples of that every day just through the work of a parent. And I got these civics lessons from her and my dad over the dinner table for many years. And so I kind of grew up just with the luck of having parents who would educate me and gave me a civic fluency and an ability to understand the government and understand that it can sometimes be used to do things that do benefit our lives.
Isn't that a little idealistic these days? I mean, you know, many people don't think the government is actually able to accomplish much in terms of good and helping people. And, you know, do you still have that sense of, you know, the government is there for us?
I think of it in terms of different levels of government. And I certainly agree that right now the federal government seems pretty bleak and that people are more obsessed with fighting on X or scoring political points and then fundraising off of that with text messages and emails to us that we all get constantly and are annoyed by. So it does feel that at the federal level, there's just more partisan warfare and a reality show. But I also understand, and I know you do too, that that is just one level of government that affects our life and that our state government affects us arguably more than the federal government and on down to our county and our city. And if you look all across the country, there are constantly examples of local and state governments making things better for people that don't get covered in the national media. Maybe they get covered in local outlets like yours, like NPR or PBS in local markets, but they definitely don't make the national news. And so I think we're constantly presented of examples, high profile examples of government not working and the moments where it does just get buried under the rug.
Yeah, so a part of that is the explanation you like to do through the various outlets, right, through the PBS series and your book. What Does the Constitution Actually Say? A non-boring guide to how our democracy is supposed to work. What makes this non-boring?
Thought you might ask that. So the reason I call it a non-boring guide is I wanted to take out all the stuffiness and the pomp. And this is not a criticism of professors like yourself. But there are some people who tend to overcomplicate things. And look, obviously, the Constitution is both short and complicated, written in a dialect of over 200 years ago. Words don't mean the same thing today that they may have meant back then. And so it's hard to parse out. So I wanted to take the experience of just me as a friend sitting with somebody at a bar for 3 hours, 4 hours. How would I break down the Constitution in the simplest way possible? And also, what examples and analogies could I use from pop culture and current day to help illustrate what the provisions of the Constitution actually mean. So it has the feel of a conversation, hanging out with a friend. There are jokes, there's levity, and hopefully that makes the information go down a lot smoother.
How do we get people to do that, to go hang out at a bar and talk about issues of democracy? I mean, you know, you go to the bar and you debate the latest football scores or latest scandal in Hollywood. But you seem, you know, to want to get people to have those barroom conversations, but about the Constitution, and you wrote a book doing that. How do we get people to actually do that on a more prevalent scale?
So I had an epiphany a few years ago, and it actually led to me writing the book, which is I would do voter turnout work in 2016 and 2018, sort of fusing the entertainment world and the political world to help get young people engaged and to register to vote and to vote. And I would hold events, and we would have representatives from states across the country come and speak, or somebody who was a secretary of state in a state like Michigan or Georgia or something like that. And they would come speak, and there would always be a portion for questions after, right? And no one would ask a question. No one would raise their hand. And then afterward, people would come up to the speakers on the panel and ask their questions individually. And I would go, well, there was a section for questions. Why didn't you raise your hand? And they all had the same answer. I didn't want to look dumb. There is a massive crisis of people not participating in government, not wanting to talk about government in any kind of public setting because they feel ashamed for not understanding how it works. And that's what led me to look at the state of civic education in the country. And, you know, yes, most states do require some amount of civics, but it's pathetic. I mean, only 7 states require at least a year. Most states require half a year. And we're talking about between kindergarten and 12th grade. And a lot of states require none. Most states don't require any kind of civics test to graduate. So we're not teaching this stuff. The only reason I went to school in DC, by the way, a few miles from the Capitol, and I got half a year in 8th grade, and that was it. And the Capitol's literally down the street from my school. So we're just not teaching this stuff in the same way that we used to many decades ago. And as a result, we're graduating people who are embarrassed to talk about this because they don't want to seem stupid. So if we can all just lose the shame, shake it off, understand that it's not our fault if our schools didn't offer it or you didn't have a parent who happened to work in the Senate and teach you, and all admit that we may not know as much as we'd like to, and let's all get caught up together. And studies show that people do participate more if they understand how government works. So hopefully the work that you do, the way that you educate people through your show and through your classes and your books and the way I do it, we can all get people more informed so they can have those conversations at bars.
What's your reaction to the states that have passed civics requirement, but the requirement is that to graduate from high school, you have to pass the citizenship test, the same test that new citizens have to pass? I have my own views, but I'm curious for yours. Is that a good approach, or is that leaving a lot on the table?
Well, the citizenship test is only 6 out of 10 questions. So if you were to give all 100 questions, you know, maybe that seems more like a test that could be passed. You know, studies also do show that only about 1 in 3 people born in the United States can actually pass the citizenship test, which is not great. If I were to wave a wand and somehow convince every state education superintendent or education board or school district to, you know, require the proper amount of civics education, I would do 3 full years required. I would do 1 in 4th grade, I would do 1 in 8th grade, and 1 in 12th grade, sort of different stages of your life. So you get a basic familiarity at a young age, a little bit more hands-on when you're, you know, a young teenager, and then when you're getting ready to graduate and becoming an eligible voter, you get more hands-on education. And it wouldn't just include education about the federal government. It would include your state, your city, your county. You know, if we barely cover civics at the federal level, we definitely don't cover it at the state or local level. So I don't have an issue with requiring the citizenship test to graduate. If that's what schools decide that they want, I would hope it would be more than 10 questions. But I do think there should be some kind of civic test, aptitude test, in order to graduate from school.
My own view is that states say you have to pass a citizenship test and then think they've fixed the problem. And that test is mostly rote memorization. It doesn't actually show you how government works. And as we were discussing earlier, how government can make people's lives better through real processes that they actually have an effect on people's lives. And so I favor, in fact, you know, there was a school in Washington, D.C. I wrote about in my first book that required students to graduate to engage in a local action civics project where they actually had to get involved with the local government. And to me, that is even a better approach. I mean, I guess I'm fine with the citizenship test if that's part of the curriculum, but I think people need to be engaged in how it affects their everyday lives, which leads me to my next question for you, which is, you know, you mentioned the school, the K-12 civics problem, but you seem focused on educating adults, you know, who are already out of schooling, and yet people are busy. You know, we have work, parenting responsibilities, everyday lives. How do you get them to embrace the importance of this topic with everything else going on?
Well, I do it in really bite-sized pieces on social media. So most of the things that I post and upload are, you know, 60 to 90 seconds. And, you know, at some point in the day, someone can probably find a minute or a minute and a half to watch a video explaining something, the fundamentals and the basics of something that they saw happen in the news. I do think that as people get older, they actually understand the importance of government more. They see the impact on their life when it comes to the cost of housing, when it comes to, you know, zoning. Housing is such a huge issue right now, and I think it didn't really get fully appreciated in the last election. And that's largely a state and local issue. In fact, I was part of some focus groups that interviewed voters under the age of 30, and it didn't matter what state we were in, what the demographic makeup of the groups were. Every single group of young people under 30 said that housing was their big issue. And that's something that is directly impacted by state and local governments in terms of where you can build single, family housing versus multi-unit, how expensive it is to build these units of housing and what kind of regulations you can go through. It's much different in California than it is in Texas. And so I think as people get older, they start to see the impact of government on their personal lives. I mean, student loan reimbursements, even to bring it back to voting, the way that we vote, whether we can vote by mail or in person, if we need an excuse, stuff like that. Basically, everything that we do is somehow impacted by the government, and we don't really understand that until we get older. So now we have an audience. I have an audience on social. Other people who do this work also are building audiences on social that understand that this is something that's not just like a snooze class in school. It directly impacts their life. And I think there's a general understanding that civics and personal finance are probably the two most important subjects that we could learn in school that we definitely don't get enough of.
Yeah, and to that end, Kentucky did pass a law recently to require both financial literacy and civic literacy as part of a graduation requirement. And so that's just being implemented now. And another example of how in this space in civic education and voting rights, Kentucky actually has been a model in recent years for places around the country. We're talking with Ben Sheehan, who has a new PBS series out called Civics Made Easy. Ben, there have been major cuts to public programming and really a lot of attacks on civic education in general. How do you think that impacts the work you are trying to do?
Well, it's definitely been disheartening to see PBS specifically become so politicized. You know, obviously growing up, I had an appreciation for shows like Sesame Street and Square One and Mr. Rogers that taught me a lot of basics. And I think the understanding, at least among from my mom and other people who worked in government, was that this was a way to provide quality early childhood education and resources to people that maybe don't have access to good preschools or great teachers. And so it gave a real service. And today, local PBS affiliates do things like, you know, emergency alerts, or they do local news. I mean, you're very familiar with this, hosting a show on a local NPR station. It's not just yelling about the federal government and what divides us at the, you know, national level. There are things that get reported on, and oftentimes PBS or NPR are really the best local news option in various communities. There are 1,600 stations total between PBS and NPR across the country and local affiliates. And so the federal defunding, which is about $550 million a year that gets spread across the two, you know, most of that money goes to local affiliates. It doesn't go to, you know, the national programming for PBS or for NPR. And so really what these cuts are doing is they are depriving local news stations and local radio stations of resources and things that inform people about what's going on in their city or their town. So I hope that you know, social media accounts like mine, shows like mine, books like mine, the work that you do, the work that a lot of other people in the space are doing can make up that gap. Because as that funding goes away, then important civic and news coverage goes away.
So let me tell you a story that informs the current project I'm working on, and I'd love to hear your reaction. Right after the November 2024 election, I saw a handful of news stories talking about how voter engagement was really high, that it was a very high turnout election. It was the second highest in a century, second only to 2020. And yet voter turnout was 63.9% nationwide. Over a third of the eligible electorate did not show up. In your work, you've talked about ignorance as a big threat to democracy. There's also concerns about disillusionment. So how do we think about the voter turnout issue in this country as it relates to your work on civic education?
In the same focus groups where housing was the number one policy, we also did a survey about people who don't participate. And to your point, 90 million people, give or take, every presidential election who are eligible to vote do not cast a ballot. And the reasons through these surveys, now this has to do with voters under the age of 30 or 35, but the reasons that a lot of these voters gave, or non-voters, I should say, gave, is that they didn't, there are some people who are always going to vote, a small, you know, let's say call them 14% or so of young people will always cast a ballot, they're civically engaged, et cetera. And then you have people who just have no interest in politics, they think it's all corrupt, they're more of the, you know, cynical, burn it down, tear it up from the roots, start over type of crowd. Again, that's a pretty small minority. But then you have this big chunk of people, and there are really two reasons that they self-report not voting and not participating. One is that they don't believe government is effective. They haven't seen examples of government benefiting their own lives. They haven't seen government benefiting the lives of people that they love or care about or that are friends of theirs. And they think that it just creates more problems than it solves. Now, that can be solved by showing people exactly, you know, the things in their lives that government does affect, because I think that does relate a lot to civic education. But I certainly don't fault people for being disillusioned about government, especially in this current climate. I fully understand that. But I do think that there are examples that they may not be hearing about in the media, and understanding the direct connection that government may have on their lives and actually the ability that they do have to affect it at the state and local level. And the second reason is that people say that they don't understand it, and that is a huge barrier to participation. So theoretically, of the 90 million people who don't cast a ballot, 30 million may be not movable. 30 million could be moved given examples of government actually working that they may not be aware of. And 30 million could be moved to vote based on understanding more about how it works. And that's all self-reported.
That's really fascinating, and I think that's useful for, again, my project, which I'm looking at the issue of non-voters. Do you think that would change election outcomes and thereby change policies?
I think it would drastically change election outcomes. I can't say that it would necessarily change outcomes immediately at the federal level, but at the state and local level, where, you know, only a few people turn out in local elections. I live in the Los Angeles area, and Los Angeles, you know, primary elections, I mean, sometimes you get turnout levels of like 8 to 12%. I mean, it's absolutely insane. And, you know, someone once said the further you move down the ballot, the closer you get to your front door. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's true. And these elections that are arguably the most impactful and, you know, affect us day to day have the least turnout and the least awareness. So I do think that, you know, educating people more about government, showing them these examples of government actually affecting their lives in a positive way, or having the potential to do that, would absolutely change what every city and town and state looks like. And if it gets to a certain level, the federal level as well.
I love that you're talking about the impact and role on local government and local elections, because that's my same response as well. You know, I think if the other 90 million voted in the 2024 election, Trump might have won again. Harris might have won. I think there's some conflicting data that's out there. But surely we have essentially results that are, I don't want to say random, but almost random at the local level when you have these super low turnout elections. I saw one, I think it was 2015's Dallas mayoral election, had a turnout of 6% of the eligible electorate in, you know, a major city. So we have a democracy problem, I think, that can be solvable by some of the things you are talking about. But that leads me to my next question, which is, how can people get involved? You know, what's one thing that individuals can do to help save democracy?
Well, I'll give you an example. A few months ago, I went to a town hall for my local city council person. And I live in a city of, say, 150,000, 170,000 people. I think there were 40 people at the meeting, maybe. And the fire chief was sitting there and the police chief was sitting there and my city council person. And they were kind of like, you know, here's what's up. Do you have any questions for us? That was a pathetic turnout. And people don't know about these opportunities to interface with their representatives. Another thing that is really important, I think, for state politics is to understand what's happening in your state capital city. I always suggest that people subscribe to the main newspaper in their capital city because that tends to have the best coverage of the state legislature and the laws that are coming out of the state house or the state capital, I should say. And then the same thing for the, you know, local outlets in their city or their county so that they can get good coverage of what's happening at the local level. There's a huge list, obviously, yes, registering to vote, volunteering at polling places, joining civics groups, single issue groups, whatever it is. But on a basic informational level, if you have the opportunity to go to town halls, especially for, you know, local reps, do it. If you have the chance to subscribe, if you can, if it's, you know, free, great. If you need to have a paid subscription, if you're able to afford it, if you can subscribe to the main news outlet in your state capital, so you have a better understanding of what state laws are coming down the pipeline or state constitutional amendments. And then I would also say on a bigger scale, getting familiar with the ballot measure process. If you happen to live in a state that does allow for ballot measures, which as we know, was only about half, maybe a little bit more than half, understanding how that process works and also understanding it at the city and the county level, because if your reps are not listening to you in a lot of cities and a lot of states, you have the ability to do something about it yourself.
Ben, tell us how we can find you on social media and elsewhere.
You can find me on Substack. My Substack is called Politics Made Easy, and my Instagram handle is Ben Sheehan, and it's Ben Sheehan across most social platforms.
Ben Sheehan is the host, writer, and producer of the PBS series Civics Made Easy, and the author of the book, What Does the Constitution Actually Say? A Non-Boring Guide to How Our Democracy is Supposed to Work. Ben, thanks so much for joining Democracy Optimist.
Thanks for having me.
Josh, you just talked with Ben Sheehan, who's the host and writer-producer of Civics Made Easy on PBS, and you ask him how civics may be never more important for all of us to understand than it is today, and yet something that hasn't been much of a priority in education. How to get everybody interested in learning how civics work? What stands out to you from how Ben answered that?
I love the way he talked about having conversations regarding issues of democracy, of civics, in a bar, right? Going with your friends and sitting around and talking about issues in a fun way. It doesn't have to be boring. It doesn't have to be technical or have a lot of legalese involved. You know, he's really dedicated at making this stuff easy and understandable. And that image of people going to the local watering hole, going to a restaurant, sitting around with your friends, or maybe it's a coffee shop, and sitting around and talking about the issues of the day and doing so in a way that's both informative and entertaining. I think that's really important. To me, civic health has to be part of the everyday experience. It has to be the sort of thing we talk about on a daily basis as a normal routine thing. We shouldn't need to set aside, okay, this is our civics education moment or the civics education portion of our conversation. I think what he's really trying to do is make that part of our everyday conversations. And that image to me, I keep going back to, of sitting around with your buddies at the bar or at the coffee shop and talking about these issues really resonated with me.
What else stands out to you from what Ben had to say about civics education and about the conversation around it?
I thought it was interesting when he talked about going to his own city council meeting or meeting with the city council member and the fire chief, and so few people were there. It demonstrates that these issues impact people's daily lives, and yet we, you know, scream at each other on social media about what's going on in the federal government. and don't engage enough in our local conversations. And so I thought the other aspect of the civics education component is really becoming involved in local government and showing up for these kinds of meetings. Maybe put down your phone when you feel like sending off a screed on social media about what you're hearing coming out of Washington, and instead engage in local government and local democracy.
Thanks for joining us for this series of conversations about how elections work, about the value of your vote, and about challenges to your right and freedom to make choices at your local polling place. Find our series online at democracyoptimist.com. Joshua Douglas, writer and host, Mike Savage, executive producer. I'm Tom Martin, your series producer. Neil Kesterson, technical director and sound designer. Democracy Optimist theme song, American, by Madeline Peru. Mason Graber and Stephen Dabney, research assistants, Caitlin Douglas, graphic designer, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. Democracy Optimist is a special Eastern Standard series produced by Dynamics Productions for Richmond, Kentucky-based public radio station WEKU.